Good morning, diners and travelers and Sunday morning folk everywhere. And Rabideau?
Yeah, I'm here this morning. It's a good job I'm here. I guess we're doing a little more of my duty than usual in this week's program because we're more on the beverage side of things. Not for a complete program, but certainly with some very interesting and different aspects of the beverage business.
Well, I think we ought to say thank you and welcome to our visitors, our listeners. You're listening to On the Menu Radio.
Oh, didn't we do that?
No.
We forgot.
With Ann and Peter Haig.
There we go.
And we're going to be talking a lot about drinks this show, but not totally, although we have more drinks coming up in later shows. It seems to be a drink kind of time of the year.
Well, it's a time of the year when you have to take on a little extra liquid. So you're not supposed to take on alcoholic liquid, but I guess we do nevertheless. But so whatever they say, I still think beer is the best thing to drink on a hot summer's day. So I'm going to do that a little bit later on today.
Right.
But you might ask yourself the question, who needs another wine competition? There have been wine challenges all the way from the one that was in the movie Bottle Shock. There are numerical rankings from Robert Parker and Wine Spectator and Wine Enthusiast and all those interesting places.
Yeah, I think you actually asked.
So why do we need another one? And the answer, of course, is in the interview with Paul Pechalt, who decided with a few of his best friends that what was needed was the ultimate wine challenge.
It's been so hot in Pittsburgh that Peter's been listening to and watching more television in the evening than usual, and the other evening I tuned in to another movie. It ended, and I did a little bit of dialing for dolls and came up with the last part of the movie called Bottle Shock.
Oh, yes.
Well, you might think, well, why, Peter, why are you talking about Bottle Shock? And there's a reason why. Those of you who know the event know that in 1976, a crazy English wine merchant in Paris got the idea of doing a blind tasting of best California wines versus the best French wines, and the result was very surprising. There have been a number of events similar to that, but now we've come across a fascinating character called Paul Pechalt, who it turns out was a radio broadcaster about wine in years past, and he decided that there was a need for another wine challenge. So go ahead, Paul. What craziness drove you to do this?
Really, what was imperative to me was, after being a wine judge and a spirits judge and a cocktail judge for many, many years, over 30 different competitions around the world, I realized that the methodology that was being used harkened back all the way to the very first competitions held in Austria, Italy, and France in the 1880s. Mm. And I realized, why is this happening? And a lot of my friends within the wine and spirits industries were saying to me they had lost faith in a lot of the competitions because of questionable methodology, because of questionable qualifications about judges. And so it was clear to me that we needed a new direction.
It doesn't go a little bit like this, is it? In blind tasting, you can be really good at it, but nothing beats a look at the label or a sneaky look at the cork.
That is precisely true. And one of the things that Ultimate Beverage Challenge, one of our credo is very simple. It's integrity, methodology, and credibility. Integrity in getting the very best, most qualified experts who will taste blind, and methodology in that we taste everything blind. We use the proper glassware. We match glassware specifically to the wine type, to the spirit type, to the cocktail type. We serve wines and spirits at their proper temperatures. We go the extra mile that in many ways, many of the competitions that I was involved in as a judge, I'd be shaking my head thinking, this wine is too warm, this wine is too cold, or we have too many wines in front of us and there's the threat of palate fatigue. So it was imperative to me and my partners Sue Woodley and David Talbot that we create a judge-friendly environment.
Okay, now, there were 500 wines in your challenge. How did you choose them?
We didn't choose them. They chose us.
Okay, go ahead.
We put the word out to the industry that we were charting some new territory in terms of judging methodology by using the top experts that we could get a hold of for 3 days. And they really chose us. The winemakers sent their wines, and the vast majority of cases sent a nice cross-section of wines, both inexpensive and expensive, which I actually really like. And so they honored us by choosing us, and I think by seeing that we were trying to do something different.
Now, you did a 100-point scoring basis kind of thing.
That's correct.
But you didn't do it the same way as Wine Spectator does and Wine Enthusiast, I think. Don't they also factor the price into their computation, I think, don't they?
To my knowledge, they do. Just about every publication that does employ the 100-point system does factor in prices.
Right, so a $30 wine might get a 95 score. A wine that costs $100 would have to be that much better in order to get a 95 score. And that's what I'm referring to.
That's correct.
Whereas you tested completely blind.
We did. We did group the wines together so that like would be with like.
Okay, yes.
Because that would often be, at least in my mind, very unfair to be putting in one wine, a Pinot Grigio for $7.99 with $60 Chardonnays. That obviously would not be advantageous to the Pinot Grigio. So we did very carefully segregate the wines and offer them in small flights to the judges. So
now, you were not a judge. You organized it, right?
I organized it, and I'm the judging chairman, so that all the wine scores eventually go through me. I had the control committee that if some results and looked a little bit odd because of a wine that we knew was traditionally and had pedigree of being good, then I would double check that. So I was kind of the checks and balances for
okay.
the judges.
So if you got a what you might call an unexpectedly low or an unexpectedly high score, then you stepped in and said, "No, let's taste this again."
Precisely. The good thing is that only happened once.
That's amazing.
It was amazing, and no one was more surprised than me. I figured, well, maybe the control panel would have to step in maybe a dozen times, maybe 15, maybe even as high as 20. But the judging panels were so rock solid and competent and in tune with each other that only happened once. And so I was very pleased. Obviously, the judges, the panels, the four panels of three experts just got on really well. And they were very industrious and very, very serious. And I think what really helped them was limiting the amount of flights per day so that there wouldn't be palate.
Oh, okay. So you didn't do everything at once. You did several days.
Oh, good grief, Nelly. Couldn't possibly.
I've been to too many wine judging competitions where all of a sudden you'll have a flight of 18 Zinfandels.
I know, it's terrible. And my worst one was Spanish Reds.
And at least speaking in my case, you know, I want to break into tears when I'm sitting in front of 18 to 20 Zinfandels. So for the judge's sake and also for the result's sake, we kept the flights to no more than 10, and no panel had more than 6 flights per day. So it was very manageable. They gave us tremendous attention to the wines. They were really, really careful about their scoring, and I think it really showed in the results.
Well, the amazing thing, there were 20-some different categories and winners in each one. One of the most fascinating ones that struck my attention was in the Pinot Grigio department.
Yes.
The winning wine was from Mesa Corona, which is a fine maker.
Yes.
But this is priced, according to the trade, at $9.99 a bottle. And it won in the Pinot Grigio category against wines that presumably were several times that price.
And I was really glad to see that, because it really showed to me how far the technology of winemaking has come just in my lifetime. I worked in the wine industry in California for 10 years, from 73 to 82 for Rod Strong. And so seeing it from a production side, which that's how I cut my teeth in the industry, seeing a wine that is reasonably priced come away with the chairman's trophy, I was delighted about that.
Great. Now, let's forget to include the website where you can get all the winners. So there is. I know there's a website, but why don't you read it into the program for us?
Well, the website
is how people
for all Ultimate Beverage Challenge competitions, of which there have been three this year, spirits, cocktails, and wine. That website is www.ultimate-beverage.com.
Here are some interesting results for people who perhaps need a little more guidance about where to shop for wines. They're shopping safely and they're probably spending more than they need to as a result, because the winning sparkling wine, as opposed to champagne, was from the wonderful Domaine Carneros house, where we've interviewed the founder and current president, Eileen Crane, and talked to her about her wines. So the best sparkling wine is a pink sparkling wine.
Yes.
Non-vintage rosé, Domaine Carneros Cuvée La Pompadour.
And that was one that that was not surprising at all to me, because, and myself as well, being a huge admirer of Eileen and what she's done, truly a trailblazer, not just for women winemakers, but for the sparkling wine category that's outside of France. That didn't surprise me at all, and I was really glad to see her efforts and her teams getting recognition from such a prestigious group of judges.
But here's some interesting stuff going on in the Riesling category. Hoag Cellars, which is Washington State, I believe, was the winner for Riesling.
Yes, and it showed tremendously well. There again, no surprise. Here is a winemaking team that have been together for a long time. Vines for Riesling that they choose grapes from are all really well established, over 15 years. So I think the quality is showing across the board of the price spectrum. And I think that's what's really important, that people understand that really good wines don't necessarily have to cost $25 and up.
Yeah, that's what people have been preaching lately, and I think that that's very good. How do you anticipate that the average wine aficionado or consumer will use this Ultimate Wine Challenge? Will they just go and check on your periodically on your website, or what?
At the moment, Anne, it seems as though the website's getting a lot of hit. Once we conclude a competition, because of the wonderful publicity that UBC has gotten since we formed late last year, the website has had tremendous amounts of traffic, which we've been very gratified at. But also I think a lot of the people who are writing about us are writing about all the Chairman's Trophy winners in spirit, cocktails, and wine. So there's been a lot of play within the general print media, which has been wonderful, because this way people can really see that we're an equal opportunity competition.
Yeah, I mean, in the white international category. Now, your white category, I guess, is broken up into several different classes. So that you have a white Italian category. The White International, won by a great old Australian winemaker called Peter Lehman.
Yes.
With a wine going out at $16 a bottle.
Very nice, and I was so happy for Peter when I was in Australia in that year 2000, and he and his team were just so gracious and showed me a lot in terms of innovation and what they were doing. And Peter actually walked away with two Chairman's Trophies, I was happy to say.
Right.
And, you know, well-deserved, well-deserved.
He was the winemaker at Yolumba, I discovered. I didn't know that. He was the winemaker at Yolumba for any number of years until he set out on his own.
That's right.
Now, do you rotate the judges in any given category? I mean, I know you're going to have different judges for your cocktails and from your wine, but do you have, like, do you rotate wine judges?
That's a really good question, and I'm happy to say that we've attracted so many experts from the different fields of beverage alcohol that we're able to place the very, very finest experts with their particular field of authority. Dale DeGroff for cocktail.
Oh, yeah.
Steve
and his wife, I understand. I haven't been able to get her book, but she has a book out, too.
Yes, but called Lush Life. and it's absolutely brilliant, because it's all of Jill's funny little illustrations with stories about different people within the beverage alcohol industry. But we match, if people would look at the judges page on the website and look at the roster of judges that we have, authors, consultants, retailers, buyers, just the creme de la creme, but we match them with their particular expertise when it comes to the challenges. And that's really the strength of what we're doing.
Well, I think it's a great new chapter in wine rating. Maybe perhaps you won't be quite as pompous as the Emperor of Wine, so-called, Mr. Parker.
I've known Bob for a long time, and I look at it this way, is my feeling is that there have been a lot of wonderful people doing a lot of really good work for many years, and we're just standing on their shoulders, and maybe we're doing things in a little bit different way. Maybe we're doing things in a more technologically advanced way that really befits the 21st century. The reality is our policy is very simple. We would never, ever denigrate anybody who's done work before us. That's just how we operate.
And not only that, but you, if you didn't do this, you could be a member of the ambassadorial staff on any given country.
Well, my mother always told me never to be a diplomat, but I always...
You are.
I really believe that, you know, everybody's work is valuable, and I've had a wonderful position in over 30 years of doing this where I have friends all over the world, and I respect what everybody's doing, and I'm not afraid to admit that I'm perfectly willing to steal good ideas and to see what other people do and integrate what they do into our process and maybe come up with a different amalgamation of ability and skills that we've kind of married now with some really good, some neat technology so that we're making a statement in a different way.
What are you going to drink with dinner tonight?
Actually, we're going to have some wonderful wine from one of my favorites, Italian, Tuscan producers, Terra Bianca, and it's one of their Merlots from 2006, and I've made a wonderful sauce. Hopefully it'll be wonderful. Hope Sue doesn't divorce me over the sauce, because I maybe made it a little bit too spicy, but we'll have it with some penne, and life is good.
Great. Well, we're having 2005 Viognier from Gary Eboli.
Oh,
good.
From, nice.
From Paso Robles with a cheeky, unsourced, broiled halibut with some garden Swiss chard on the side.
Well, that would work.
We can't wait.
And weeds, my salad of weeds. Yeah. I've taken to foraging, and I finally convinced Peter he can eat some of these things. I eat them first, and if I don't die, then you can do the salad.
So we can't wait for next year's award winners. And Paul, we appreciate your joining us on the program today. Yeah. And listeners, you're going to want to follow what this group is doing, I'm sure. So Paul, congratulations on your new venture, and we wish you every success, which we know you'll have.
Oh, you two are so kind, and I'm really delighted to be on the program. Thanks so much for giving us the opportunity to talk about.
Well, it's fascinating, and we really, I just think it is a whole new chapter. Thank you so much, Paul, and keep us posted.
Will do. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So there you have it, and I think...
Time Paul, for another break.
Well, hold on. I think Paul actually invited us to join the next Ultimate Wine Challenge as judges, so
yeah,
maybe we'll have more at the next one. It sounds like it might be fun, and he's certainly got a very interesting idea and a lot of good information you can follow up on. And as Anne said, now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu as we continue our exploration of adult beverages. Those of you who follow Mad Men probably think that the ultimate of chic drinking is Scotch on the Rocks, which seems to have been the case back then. But as with everything else, today's hip population seeks out more exotic fare, and we have two examples of that coming up in the segment.
Yeah, we're really exotic. First of all, a beverage from Peru, which is not exactly on the mainstream track of most people's view as to where fascinating beverages come from, but Herbie Lobo is certainly going to explain why and what the significance is of the noble spirit of Peru called Pisco. And then, not to be outdone, it turns out these guys are acquaintances. We have a rather unusual flavor of vodka. Sweetheart, you get to say something about this.
Why bacon vodka?
Why bacon vodka? Yeah, bacon.
I think we asked that question.
The next thing will be bacon and egg vodka, and you'll be able to have it for breakfast. But anyway, we'll find out from Stefan why he and his friends decided they would do that and what success they're enjoying. So Pisco and then potato vodka flavored with bacon. What a combination.
The first time I heard the word Pisco, I thought, you know what? This is a fairly unfortunate sounding name for a drink. But I'm guessing that it means something special in Peruvian, and Herbie Lobo, who's Peruvian, is certainly the man to tell us about.
Yeah, it's originally a word that it actually has multiple meanings. It originated from a city that is the lower part of Peru. It's a valley in the southern part of Peru called Pisco. The word comes from the word Pishku, which is a Quechua word, which is a Peruvian Indian language that was indigenous to the Incas, and that's still spoken today in areas like in Cusco and in the interior of Peru. And that word really came to mean a bunch of different things. It came to mean, for example, Pishku in Quechua was not only the name of the city in the valley, it was also the name of the native birds from that region. It also became the name of ceramic, I guess, the ceramic jars that were used to carry pisco in the early days were also named piscos. So when the liquor started being produced and then being transported in these ceramic jars called piscos, that's when it ended up actually becoming that the distilled spirit became the name pisco.
How old is this?
Pisco originated in, I want to say, the late 1600s. I don't have the exact date, but it really came to exist when the Spaniards brought grapes to the Americas for the first time for wine producing. King Philip II in Spain at one point, from pressure from the local farmers and the local winemakers in Spain, illegalized the importation of wine from the Americas. And that created almost a vacuum in the region, where there was all these wine producing areas and they didn't have a place to sell the wine, and the local indigenous people wanted to have a stronger beverage. They didn't like wine. They didn't like the sweet, low alcoholic wine. So they ended up distilling it out, and that's where Pisco came from. And that was anywhere from 300 to 350 years ago.
Now it's basically fermented grape juice. Correct?
Yeah, it's Pisco is basically an unaged brandy. We use grapes that come from a vineyard, specific grapes, different varietals that we have in Peru that we use for Pisco producing. We ferment them out like a wine for about 18 days, and then we take that must, that juice, and put it in a copper pot still and distill it to proof. It's actually the only spirit category in the world that collects body and distilled at proof and bottles at that. There's no other that does it this way.
Now, we sampled some just a little bit ago, getting ready for the program.
Okay.
And our take on it was, boy, this tastes an awful lot like grappa, and especially a version of grappa, which is called, we know it's made by the Nonino family, called uve. And the difference between grappa and uve is made from grape juice, just like pisco.
Yes.
Whereas grappa is made from the skins and the stones and everything else you can imagine.
Exactly. That's where the difference between grappa and pisco, when somebody first opens up a bottle of pisco, it does have some of the same aromas. The subtlety and the softness, if you will, of a pisco drink versus a grappa drink, which is a lot more fiery, is the fact that you are using that first press, so you get a lot more of that characteristic and body from the grape juice, where, like you said, the grappas are using the skins and the second press of the grape and everything that's left over after they've pressed it out for making wine.
Now, this is exceptional, though. This is a pisco, which is Gran Sierpe.
Yes.
And that's your family's brand?
Yes. It's actually my father and I own it. We began the project really trying to link a historical fact with a family that we're partners with in Peru that has a very long-standing history in pisco producing, that comes from a small city in the south of Peru called Montesierpe. And that's kind of a play, it's kind of a play on word to mean mountain snake. And when we linked with this family that had a history and owned a distillery 300-400 years ago, you know, we wanted to link it to that original story, and we wanted to have a very high quality premium product that can also have a historical meaning behind it. And the words Gran Sierpe is great snake in Spanish, a play on the word serpiente, which is serpent. And the secondary meaning of that is that in Inca culture, the mysticism behind symbols that they used to describe different things in the earth, like the condor would be the symbol for the sky, the monkey would be the symbol for the forest, and the serpent would be the symbol for the earth.
So, okay.
Yeah, we felt that that was something that could tie it into the Peruvian culture and also be a very modern, unique take to a product.
Now, you were also trying for a quality of product, too, that was outstanding, I think.
Yeah, we definitely did not want to come out with a pisco that would be regarded as a low-quality pisco. We went above and beyond to make sure that we get the best quality grapes and the best quality production from our distillery, and think that we've captured a very nice quality pisco.
Yeah, I mean, some of this stuff is very rough, isn't it?
Some of them are definitely not as formal and not as specific in terms of quality control of the grapes that they use, so it could mean that some might not be as good as others, and we feel that ours is a pretty good premium quality pisco.
Oh, it's nice and smooth. I mean, are you supposed to sip it, or are you supposed to
You can sip it if you want to taste it on its own to see what the spirit tastes like, but we, being here at Tales of the Cocktail in New Orleans, we're experiencing a renaissance of white spirits in cocktails outside of vodka. White spirits with a character and a body, so that when a cocktail is made the right way and it's balanced, you're getting some of those flavors from the fruits and the juices that are being used in the cocktail, but you're also getting to taste that spirit, like mezcal, tequila, rum, cachaça, pisco. These are all white spirits that have a body and a character, so they lend very well to making a very good drink.
Now, you just had a competition between several top mixologists, didn't you?
Yeah, we just had one actually in Miami that we hosted, and we actually, the winner actually won a trip to come to Tales of the Cocktail. And it was an Iron Chef style competition, so we had 12 bartenders from Miami go head-to-head against each other with secret ingredients given to them right before the round. And the winner actually made a drink using tahini paste.
Oh, my goodness.
And it was a very interesting, creamy, almost like an eggnoggy kind of texture. And the drink was exquisite. We actually have it on our Facebook page.
That sounds great. I mean, it must be very yeasty flavored, huh? So tell us a little bit about where you are and what you're doing there.
Well, Tales of the Cocktail, obviously, as you know, is the once-a-year annual celebration of cocktail culture and the ability for a lot of bartenders from all over the country to get together and share ideas and innovate together about everything having to do with the bar and the beverage.
We've been there. We've been to the museum.
Yeah. Obviously, having the cocktail museum here and having such a rich culture of cocktails in New Orleans, being really the first city that created the cocktail with drinks like the Sazerac and things of that nature that are over 100 years old, this city is the perfect place to have an event like this. And having Pisco have the ability to actually share with bartenders and non-bartenders alike how versatile the spirit is, people are really gravitating to it. They're really enjoying it here.
Well, that's great. Now, why do you think all of this is becoming... I mean, Pisco is becoming extremely popular.
I think there's just a renaissance, like I said before, of consumers and trade wanting to experiment with other products. I think being bombarded with the same type of products all the time gets a little boring. You can only have so many vodkas behind a bar before you want to try something else. So,
we just had bacon vodka.
I know. I actually know... I met Stefan, actually, in Las Vegas.
We interviewed him for...
In fact, you might be on the same.
Yeah, there's a good chance.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
There's a good chance you'll be on the same program.
Oh, and Shochu is the other one. We have.
That's a good product too.
I haven't had any of that. I'm on a big learning curve here.
I think you're right about so many kinds of. How many kinds of vodka can you have? It seems the market seems to be unsaturated.
Yeah.
But at the same time, certainly people are going to be looking for something different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can see doing something with Pisco in a reinvented Sazerac, quite honestly.
Those sidecars, too, that people do because of, rather than using brandy, they're using Pisco. But you can really lend, it really lends well to many cocktails, including the most famous Pisco drink is the Pisco Sour.
Right.
Oh,
it was created by an American living in Peru in the early 1900s. His name's Victor Morris. And created that cocktail because there was no whiskey in Peru. So instead of a whiskey sour, he created the Pisco Sour, and that was almost 100 years ago.
There you go. So it's an amazing thing how these products are reinvented.
Harvey, what did they
rediscovered?
Drink? What did they drink in the Peru before they had Pisco?
The indigenous people drink almost like a moonshine that's made from corn called chicha de jora.
Oh, wow.
Which you get in Cusco and you get in the Amazon. It's literally a corn moonshine. And it's a very, very strong alcoholic product. And it's not, it's not bottled. It's not commercialized. It's just something that people make in their home.
Probably makes you blind, too, at the same time.
Yeah.
It sounds like the stuff they drink in Guatemala. that, yeah. You know, they end up, the market, the women wait to have somebody carry their husbands home.
Well, we wish you great luck and great good fortune with your new venture trying to...
Yeah, thank you so much for the time and the attention.
Well, this has been fun.
I would welcome you guys to check out our page, discoverpeaceco.com, for some more information
on the brand itself
and on the history behind it. And also, we would love for your listeners and yourselves also to become friends of ours on Facebook, where you get to see some of the stuff that we're doing to get the word out about Peaceco. So... definitely check it out on Facebook. Just, you know, search for Grand Sierra Bay Peaceco and also discoverpeaceco.com.
Okay, so that's it.
Now, hold on. There's one more application which is so fundamentally simple, but, and you probably know about it, but you haven't mentioned it, and I would recommend it, and that's to treat it just like you would a grappa, which means you keep it in the freezer.
Oh, yeah.
And you bring it out after dinner and after you've driven home.
Yeah, hopefully after you've driven home.
just to complete the evening, and I thought that treatment would be the right thing to do, and that's exactly how we're drinking it right now.
Yeah, I think if somebody wants to try the spirit on its own, that would be a definite way that I would go about it.
Great. Well, Herbie, once again, thank you so much for joining us, and back to Tales of the Cocktail for you, I guess, huh?
Thank you so much for the time. You guys have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too. Enjoy yourself, bye-bye. Herbie. Bye. Who's to say that the bacon craze is now over the top, but every time I think we've seen the end of it, a new product capitalizing on people's passion for bacon comes on the market. We're going to be talking to Stefan, is it Schachtel or Schachtel?
That's correct, Schachtel.
Schachtel, and you have a company called Black Rock Spirits, right?
Who, yeah.
And you make bacon with a K, B-A-K-O-N, vodka.
That's
which,
correct.
Yeah, well.
Okay, so the first question is why?
Absolutely, it's a very valid question. It stems from two passions of ours, of our team, and I should make note that it's three of us that started and run the organization, myself, Sven Ledeen, and Chris Marshall. And it comes from a passion all three of us share, that of vodka and that of bacon.
So henceforth they should go together?
Well, it came about at an event where we had all been sipping on our cocktails, and I think everybody has that friend that's in bacon, whether it could be you, it could be the person sitting next to you, but we're all kind of 3 degrees away from a person who is passionate about bacon, and we have that friend. He brought bacon to the party, and we started this sort of whimsical line of thinking of, you know, can we actually create a bacon-flavored vodka that tasted good? And so we started with some infusions, a bit skeptical ourselves, asking whether or not...
Let's stop a second. You say he brought bacon to the party? I mean, did you just cut it into slices and put it in the vodka, or is it too easy?
You know, we didn't start then, but that's when we kind of originated, came up with the idea. But just this idea of you can have bacon for breakfast, you're having vodka the previous evening. What would a Bloody Mary taste like, for example, with a bacon infusion? And we started thinking about all the different flavors that go with bacon and as part of breakfast, just for example, one meal. And, you know, with maple syrup, with the different kinds of bacon that are on the market, with different kinds of, smoke treatment or different flavors added. And so we decided to pull the trigger and started actually buying different kinds of bacon and infusing it with different kinds of vodka.
No, when
you said yuck.
You know,
you said yuck, didn't you?
No, we came up with probably about 14 different infusions, different combinations, and some of them were not so great, but two of them rose to the top, the rosemary pepper bacon and pepper bacon vodka.
Now let's go back to the chemistry of this whole thing. In Black Rock Spirits, do you actually distill vodka yourselves, or do you buy from somebody else?
We partner up with two different distilleries. One is a distillery in Idaho that produces the base potato spirit. They're the largest, and at the time, I believe the only potato distillery in the United States that was making kind of commercial-grade potato spirit.
And I guess they do it in Idaho because they got lots of potatoes.
They do it in Idaho because there's lots of potatoes, and they make they use that base spirit. It's called Uber Tuber, but it's a potato.
Pretty cute, Uber Tuber.
It's a potato spirit that's fantastic. It's award-winning. They do a great job with it, and we started off with that. And I should note that we tried the bacon infusion with different types of spirit, with rye, with corn, with neutral grain spirit, and, of course, potato. And potato, it tasted simply the best. It just had a slightly sweet, slightly oily note that really worked and complemented the bacon flavor.
Now, without giving away any trade secrets, I mean, when you say infuse, what does that mean?
Well, we started off with straight infusion. So we would cook the bacon, and we would put it, the cooked bacon, in the vodka and let it steep.
That's really disgusting.
You know, it's not pretty, in all honesty. It was funny. Uh-huh. One of our partners, Sven, it was at his house where we stored all the flasks and bottles of the infusion. And I remember his wife walking by and saying, "God, please get rid of those guys. It's too much. These motley assortment of containers carrying different blends and mixtures." But we decided to gather a group of friends. It was actually at a bachelor party, and they sampled it, and a lot of them did not like some of the flavors, but like I said before, two of them really worked.
Now, after you've done with the bacon, can you take it out and eat it? Or I mean, it probably ought to be pretty good bacon.
Well, no, if I remember the story correctly, you end up not using real bacon, right?
Yeah, so that's where I was going. So because of the problem that you mentioned, it's actually messy, and quite simply, you have fat in the spirit, and
yeah.
There's a couple different issues with that. One is that the appearance is not very appetizing because it's cloudy. We did our best. We filtered. We froze, but you couldn't get quite all the fat out of the base spirit, and so you're just you ended up with a bit of a suspension, and it just didn't look that appetizing.
So coming to the chase, you actually have a chemical in there, right?
Yeah, it's a naturally derived compound that we source, and it's they sent us we found a company that could give us essentially a alcohol-soluble flavor compound, and they gave us three samples. We chose one, and the one that we chose actually had no bacon in it. It's naturally derived from pepper oils, smoke flavor, and it really worked with what we wanted to achieve.
Well, it's like the bacon salt guys, right?
They're buddies of yours, aren't they?
Yeah, you know, it's actually funny. We got a lot of press initially, and people were assuming that we were the bacon salt guys, and it turns out that Justin and Dave were getting the same sort of queries, if they were the bacon vodka guys. And so it was very funny. They sent us an email, and it was really like two mafia families approaching each other at a bar, where they were the bacon salt guys, we were the bacon vodka guys. We approached each other bar. We each brought gifts for the opposing family. It was actually funny. There were three of them. There were three of us.
We've interviewed Justin, and we've had some dealings with them as well, including the bacon lollipops. It was another connection of the bacon connection.
But this is a. Do you think you created? I mean, we talked before we came on the air about savory infusions into vodka, which is a newish category. I mean, were you at the start of that category, and are there other people now doing the same thing, something similar?
Yeah, I mean, we don't claim that we invented bacon vodka. I mean, I think that it's a pretty basic process. You put bacon into vodka, you let it sit, and you drink it. I mean, that's bacon vodka. And there are certainly a number of places online to find out where to make your own. But we think that we have something new and something different in that we've made something that's commercially available, and it's stable, shelf stable, and it tastes, frankly, really good. It's appetizing, and it's fantastic in a Bloody Mary.
Yeah, I would say that my preference is to have it in the Bloody Mary. I
mean, absolutely, that's our flagship cocktail.
It's not my choice of sipping vodkas, but
yeah. No, I sipped it. I tried to get used to it. I will say this: the package has great eye appeal.
Thank you very much.
I mean, so many of the high-end vodkas, the bottles tend to look the same. I mean, the Grey Goose looks a little bit like like Belvedere. Belvedere looks a little bit like Chopin. They're all in bottles that pretend to be much bigger than that, promise much more content than there is.
Absolutely.
Instead,
and I think
instead you went cuboid.
We did. We went with some straight edges. We went with a very masculine shape. And I think that we decided early on that we wanted to come out with a premium product, in the sense that we use expensive ingredients, we don't cut corners, and we went with an expensive glass. It's a very heavy glass, and it's good quality, and it's very iconic. It's a very iconic shape.
Well, you know, bartenders, or whatever they're called now, bar chefs or whatever, mixologists, have been smoking martinis in New York for a couple of years now. So it's obviously a flavor that appeals to a lot of people.
Yeah, you know, and I think that with the rise of aged spirits like the mezcals and añejo, even scotches, for example, that savory component in a cocktail is starting to become more widespread use and become more relevant. I think that just judging from some of the cocktails that have been created for bacon vodka through some of the mixology communities in the Northwest, we've had some cocktails where they mix the bacon vodka with a Laphroaig or a smoked mezcal. And so it's something that can work as an addition to a complex cocktail in lieu of it being the primary component. I mean, obviously, a bacon Bloody Mary, we call it the Bacon Mary, is fantastic. You get the smoke, you get the meat, you get kind of all aspects of it. But
I told you before, I found that in this general category of meat-flavored vodkas, the one that I couldn't deal with at all was the smoked salmon infused vodka.
Well, doesn't that come from Wasilla, Washington?
Yes, exactly.
I mean, Wasilla, Alaska. together with other people that we know and love.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me this, Stuart. I mean, is this a single product company?
We don't believe so. No, we have ideas. Are you talking about Black Ark Spirits or the Alaska Company? No, we have other ideas, and I should say that we don't look to launch a line of bacon flavored spirits. I mean, that's not what we're about. We have other ideas that have nothing to do with bacon, and you'll see us come out with some of those, I think, in the next couple of years.
I mean, like, what kind of, is this your background? What did you do before you started making this vodka?
Well, it's kind of interesting. Chris, Sven, and myself, we come from three very different backgrounds. We're all friends, and we've been friends for quite a number of years, but Sven comes from a very a business management background, MBA program, launching multiple companies. Chris Marshall comes from a graphic design background, and I come from I'm kind of the alcohol guy. I used to work for Miller Brewing Company. After that, I worked for a beer and wine wholesaler in Washington State, and then started a liquor brokerage with my father. He still runs that company, New West Spirits. And then we decided to go this direction. So we're drawing from a great network of different backgrounds and different skills and really different perspectives and viewpoints. And I think that's one reason why we've been able to kind of get the sort of exposure that we've been able to obtain. Of course, it is bacon vodka, so it comes with a lot of weight behind it already, because it is such a unique product in such a unique category.
And it's really been a great success, huh?
Yeah, it's been amazing, actually. We started off with, I believe it was just a handful of cases, and we really thought they would last us a couple years. I mean, we had no idea what to expect, but they sold out in a few weeks, and Washington State was asking for more. Oregon started asking for product, so we realized we had something pretty incredible on our hands, and in the past year we've seen some pretty substantial growth. Of course, bacon vodka is not something that you would typically, you know, drink, you know, going out on the town, having cocktails with your friends, you know, Bloody Mary oriented, but what's been neat is that it also has seen a lot of use with, you know, pineapple juice, things like that. So, you know, coming from a culinary background, I'm sure you guys can see where, you know, obviously where bacon fits into a lot of different dishes. And what's been interesting is that if you carry that perspective onto a mixology sort of environment. You have the, you know, a melon-flavored liqueur mixed with bacon vodka is a flavor very reminiscent of prosciutto wrapped melon.
Got it. There you go. I tell you what, we have to put this man in touch with Jimmy Villis.
Oh, what, because the bacon book.
And you may or may not get along. I doubt you will get along, but it would be funny to see what the interaction was. he wrote a book. His latest book is called Pig.
Oh, wow.
He also wrote a book called Bacon.
He had a whole book about bacon. In fact, we have another bacon cookbook, too. I mean,
we had three of them in 1 year.
Bacon,
wow.
Bacon is hugely well-loved. I got to part with you on this thought. It seems to me that if bacon is for breakfast, then bacon vodka should be for breakfast.
Oh, yeah. Bloody Mary's brunch, at least.
Well, bacon's for breakfast.
There you go. We wholeheartedly agree.
we can't wait to find out what you come up with next, Stefan. So please keep in touch and let us know what's happening. Don't give us any secrets, but as soon as you can give us a scoop, we'd love to have one.
We will. Thank you so much for the interest and the great questions.
Thank you. All right. So keep up the good work and talk to us soon.
Please. And your listeners visit us on our website at www.baconvodka.com with a C or a K.
Okay, very good. I'm glad you got that in there. That's good. All right. So we'll say goodbye now until the next time. Well, stay with us now while we take another commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again. We're going to digress a bit from our exploration of drinks, but we're going to stay on track of the exotic.
I'm sure they drank something too.
Who did?
A fascinating Canadian couple who decided to set off meandering around the Mediterranean.
Oh, right.
And then wrote, and then wrote all about it in a book called The Spice Necklace. A fascinating story you'll want to hear about. I suspect you'll even want to read about it too, but you can find out more about this in the upcoming segment coming right now.
Something I would love to do, Rabbit, is get a boat and do what our next guest and her husband did.
I can give you
sail around the Caribbean.
I can give you 5 million reasons why you'd never do that. and they all start with M for mosquito.
Yeah, that's true.
but seriously, it sounds like an absolute incredible adventure. And Anne
Vanderhoof is our guest, and she has written this book called The Spice Necklace: My Adventures in Caribbean Cooking, Eating, and Island Life. And you just sound like you have a great time.
Well, we certainly do, Anne and Peter. We've been traveling on Receta. That's our sailboat. It's the Spanish word for recipe. And we call her that because I love to cook, and we both love to try all sorts of food. So it's a pretty good giveaway of what our interests are. We've been traveling on Receta for 4 years now in the Caribbean, from island to island, trying out the new foods, new ingredients we encounter everywhere we stop.
Now, Peter will undoubtedly tell the story, so I'll preempt him.
What's that?
When your friend with the sailboat invited us out in, Melbourne?
Yeah,
was it Sydney?
We're actually on a concrete hull boat in Port Phillip Bay, just outside Geelong, near Melbourne, and Anne was appointed to bring lunch.
So I did a giant plate of antipasti,
forgetting that all the olives rolled off.
The olives rolled off and rolled under all the floorboards, and he was ready to kill me.
I am entirely sympathetic because I have been there myself, where I will make something and I will garnish it with, you know, some chopped herbs or whatever, and then take it out into the cockpit, and, you know, in 1 second the herbs are everywhere except where they're supposed to be on the platter that I'm serving.
That's exactly correct. Now, this is just, at first sight, what you did seems almost mad. Has anybody ever said that to you before? I mean, you set off to places, many of which you've never heard of. You eat all these ingredients that you've never heard of. You don't really know what they contain. Did you have a lifetime supply of Pepto-Bismol and Alka-Seltzer before you set off?
Well, you know, First of all, people have told us that we're mad. And I guess the second thing is that we, before we first started doing this, we had did stock the boat with, you know, not only Pepto-Bismol, but, you know, dozens of other remedies.
Canned things.
Oh, and canned things, because somewhere in my mind, somewhere in both of our minds, the first time we, you know, headed away from North America, we must have thought that there wasn't a single place to buy food south of Florida. We had stocked the boat so well, and of course, we quickly discovered that there were all sorts of new wonderful things available. And I'm happy to report that the supply of Pepto-Bismol and other remedies remains mostly untouched.
That's great.
So you got used to it pretty quickly.
Yes, and in fact, what we've found is that it's an amazingly healthy lifestyle, and without even trying, we're eating, you know, fresh, local, seasonal foods because it's what you find in the local market.
Now, explain the.
I'm sorry?
Explain the title, The Spice Necklace.
Okay. In Grenada, in the capital of St. George's, there are women who are in the market, and they sell these wonderful, fragrant necklaces of spices. Grenada is called the Island of Spice. And these necklaces are strung with cloves and nutmegs with the mace covering still on them, pieces of ginger and pieces of what they call saffron, which is really turmeric, fresh turmeric root, and cocoa beans, and this wonderful bean called the tonka bean, which local cooks grate into batters for sweetbreads and cakes. Tonka bean smells like really wonderful vanilla with an overtone of almonds to it. So we bought these necklaces, and we hung them all over the boat. You know, they add this really lovely spicy fragrance to the air. But for us, beyond that, as we continue traveling throughout the islands, the whole island chain of the Caribbean came to be for us like a spice necklace, with each island adding kind of a different flavor to our experience.
Yes, I saw that.
The Caribbean.
I saw that map inside the cover, and it really does look like a necklace, although there are smaller beads on one side than there are on the other.
Yeah. That's right.
But you use that as a metaphor. You use the metaphor, I guess, as a structure for your book.
Yeah, that's right, where we tend to follow the spices and herbs, as it were, because in spices and herbs are really the heart and soul, the foundation of Caribbean cooking. And as we quickly learned, as people would take me under wing and show me how to cook local dishes, that nothing starts without first being seasoned up, as they say, usually in some wonderful mixture of herbs and spices.
Or the goats would eat their own herbs.
Indeed. That was such a wonderful surprise to us. There were these goats in the Dominican Republic and the far western part of the country where they graze on wild oregano, and they come to the kitchen essentially self-spiced.
Oh, people don't give them the oregano.
They graze on it.
They forage it for themselves.
It's like in Australia with all the animals eating eucalypt. And
well, the only animal that ate eucalypt that we ate was a kangaroo. And it was only the fillet of the kangaroo. I mean,
the emu, all those stuff that they raise in Texas doesn't taste at all like it does
no,
in Australia.
I'm kidding you. Yeah. But this is a book that you can treat a number of different ways, I think. First of all, listeners, I think you need to understand it's an adventure story.
Yeah, but it also has a lot of humor.
Well, I said there are several things about it.
Okay.
Now, if it's all right if I continue.
Do you argue with Steve?
I mean, you interrupt so quickly. I say several things, I get one of them out, and then you want to interrupt. The second thing is it's a tour guide of a part of the world where, you know, if you've heard about the drug lord recently in Jamaica, you wonder perhaps maybe if you want to go there. Nevertheless, it's a tour guide if you want to do that. And third, it's a cookbook.
Right. I've set out so that people just want to read about our adventures and just enjoy them from the comfort of their chair, whether it's an armchair or a beach chair, that's great. But for people who want to take it into the kitchen, each chapter at the end has some recipes that grow out of the stories that I tell in that chapter. And in each case, I've included suggestions or substitutions if there's an ingredient that just isn't available or is hard to get if you live in a part of the country that doesn't have a Caribbean population and therefore you can't get some of the ingredients. I've included substitutions.
Yeah, for years I cooked a dish from Curacao and I never could locate this one spice and I left it out. And then I finally, it became popular enough I could find it, sambal oelek.
Mm-hmm.
The dish didn't taste the same because I had been eating it without it for all that time. So, and where does that come from, Curacao?
I think, am I right that that has, where are its roots?
Well, the dish is certainly from Curacao.
Yeah, but I mean, it has to be rooted in Dutch cuisine because they eat them cheese.
Yeah, it has huge quantities of cheese in it.
Eat them.
Yeah, you made it for me. You never told me you left an ingredient out. Goodness gracious me. What a disgrace. I mean, that was I thinking I was eating cashiana curacao and it was all legit.
Oh, yes, cashiana, the stuffed cheese.
Yeah. Exactly.
But no, there's an ingredient in Trinidad, an herb in Trinidad, that locally they call chardon-benny. It comes from the French chardon-benny, good weed, but our good thistle, I guess. But it's very close. It's actually also known as culantro, which is, can be hard to get here. But since cilantro is such a close relative, that you can substitute that. And it's got a slightly different taste, but the family resemblance is there, and it serves the purpose quite well.
Now, what I started to say before when I interrupted Peter was, I mean, you write with a great deal of wit and humor, and so that I was finding myself laughing out loud when you were talking about getting directions for driving in the Dominican Republic when you said if they tell you, if a local tells you that you're going to cross two rivers, don't assume that it's by bridge.
Yes, that is absolutely true. And, you know, that was a morning where that image of our, after being told, you know, you're going to cross two rivers, and we arrive at the first river, and my mouth just fell open as I see this raging torrent that we were expected to go through in the car. And, of course, we didn't. We turned around and backtracked. But, no, we learned to ask the second question when someone gave us directions.
Is there a road, or do we need an airplane along the way?
That's right. We also learned in the Dominican Republic that when we did stop for directions, which was frequently, the person we were asking would invariably eyeball the car. They'd walk around it. They might even kick the tires. And then they would tell us that we were good to go.
Now, what kind of car was this? Was it an unusual car?
It was a standard rental car of the, you know, the kind of a small SUV persuasion. And it's just that the roads get, once you get, you know, off the main highway, the roads can get pretty rugged, and especially if it's been raining. So they were trying to ensure that we didn't get into any trouble.
Yeah, well, did you ever run into frightening, threatening situations, not from weather conditions, but from crime or anything like that? Is there danger involved?
We have not. And, you know, it's one of these things that there are certainly in the areas we've traveled, and we have not traveled to Jamaica, but there are places we travel where there are comparatively big cities like Trinidad. And what we do is, you know, even though it's the Caribbean, that creates a certain mindset, you can't forget that this is a big city, and you take the same sort of care that you would in any big city, whether it's, you know, New York or wherever.
But there aren't kidnappings like there are in Colombia and...
Well, Jamaica's really bad. Jamaica's really bad.
No, we had a friend. We remember Michael Berger had a compound.
Yes.
And I had a house in a compound in Jamaica, and some friends of his from Pittsburgh went and stayed in his condo, and somebody broke in and killed them.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, so that's good.
We have, in the places that we've traveled, secure, very safe. We find that people will look out for us, and often I'll have someone say something. Now, you hold your bag. Hold your bag close to your body.
Yeah, we've had that.
Too. And it's lovely. So it's more the opposite of people looking out for us. And the few times where I've thought, oh, there's trouble on the way. There was this one time in Trinidad that I write about in the book, where it was right before Carnival, and we were trying to learn how to chip, which is a quintessential dance step that the Trinis use when they're in the Carnival parades. And someone had taken us under wing and was showing us how to do this. And after this impromptu lesson finished, we were walking back to where our boat was docked. And this was a stretch that people, Trinidadians, had said, oh, don't walk there alone at night. But this was broad daylight. But we see this rather disreputable character coming at us from across the field, and he's yelling. And we both think, oh, it's okay, here's going to be our first negative encounter. And he keeps getting closer, and of course, we're clutching our backpacks tighter and walking faster. And he gets close enough for us to finally hear what he's yelling at us. And he's saying, don't worry, when you hear the music, you'll be fine. Just follow the music. And he's actually continuing, it was just a stranger who'd seen us practicing this dance step, and he was offering his own advice. So it showed us, you know, don't always be suspicious either.
And has there ever been a place where you really thought of settling down permanently?
Well, I'll tell you, Anne, that it happens all the time. And we haven't succumbed because of course, part of the allure of our way of travel is that we get to move from place to place, and my kitchen always travels with me, so I get to cook in each place. But it happens all the time where we'll be visiting someone on land, or we'll see a piece of property that will have, you know, a beautiful mango tree full of fruit, and a lime tree, and a papaya tree, and we think, oh, well, that's, wouldn't we love to have that piece of property? But we haven't succumbed yet, although we do think of, you know, we do fantasize about it.
So a year in Trinidad might be the next book, huh?
Yeah.
It's like a year in Provence.
Yeah, I guess.
And there was the other one in Tuscany. This is just a book filled with fascinating characters. It's just impossible to really do it justice if you're on this subject, or if you're just looking for something wonderfully escapist. The Spice Necklace will keep you amused for weeks and weeks. And we thank you so much for bringing it to everyone, and thank you so much for joining us on the program today.
Well, thank you for having me, and I hope you enjoy some of the recipes.
Yes, well, you've given my wanderlust a little boost.
There we go. And please give Steve our best regards.
And, I will, and nice to chat with you.
And eat well.
And thank you very much.
Thanks, Ann.
Well, this is, there you have it, another exciting On the Menu program. We hope to see you here, same time, same place, again next week.
Bye-bye.